and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Iraq War veteran and mental health advocate Brian Adams. Hosted by the UAA Integrated Suicide Prevention Initiative as part of the Active Minds Speakers Bureau, Brian's talk was recorded at the University of Alaska Anchorage on February 21st.
My name is Nathaniel Jenkins, and I'm a member of Student Activities. And Student Activities is happy to work alongside Active Minds putting on this event, and we're happy to introduce Brian Adams to you guys. He is a graduate of Rutgers University School of Business, and currently he's working as a fellow with The Mission Continues, which focuses on community service across America. And he also works as a spokesperson for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And Brian is going to be here with us tonight to speak on the power of resilience and the importance of mental health. So I'd like to introduce Brian to you guys. Thank you.
Well, thank you guys for coming out. I've been really enjoying my time since I've been out here. This is the first time I've been to Alaska. This is a completely different world for me. I'm from New Jersey. You know, it's flat. There's, you know, densely populated suburbs. People really aren't that nice. So I'm enjoying this, you know, polite atmosphere of beauty. So, I went to high school in New Jersey. I grew up there my whole life. I had about 90 people in my graduating class. I was never really focused on going to college. All I really cared about in school, in high school, was playing sports. And I played soccer, baseball, I ran track, just everything, any sport I could really get into, I was interested in. I decided that I wanted to go into the military when I was a junior. I come from a family of military people. My grandfather served in World War II. And he used to watch me as a kid growing up, and just hearing his stories, and just seeing the way that he carried himself. He was just held on to that professionalism, that sense of duty to country, and he kind of instilled that in me. And when I was a senior, the events of 9/11 happened, and I just remember how surreal it all was, just seeing that unfold on the television. And just having that feeling that, we're under attack. Our country's under attack. It was a very energizing moment, in my life, seeing that, and I really just solidified the fact that, this was something that I wanted to do. I wanted to go in. I wanted to do more with my life. I wanted to challenge myself. And so I joined the Army when I was 18. I didn't tell my mom that I joined until about 2 weeks before I left for basic training. I just kind of dropped it on her, and needless to say, she was pretty shocked. She was not happy with the decision, but I was 18 years old, and I had already made up my mind, and I explained to her that this was something that I had to do. I left for basic training. This was the first time I was ever away from home, and it was a total just shock to me. The whole environment, just being in there with, you're from the second you see how it is in some of these TV shows. From the second you get off the bus, you're getting yelled at. Someone's in your face. They're calling you all kinds of names. They're keeping you up at night. You're never comfortable. You're always tired. You always have something to do. You don't never feel like you ate enough. Just the whole system is designed to try to toughen you, to try to just break you down, and take away your individuality and rebuild you as someone who can function, in an Army unit, someone who can take orders without question, and someone who can, is strong enough to handle, what you're going to potentially face in a combat zone. And, I just remember the first day I was just sitting on my bunk that first night, and I just had, I was literally homesick. You know, I had the sickening feeling in my stomach, and I was like, man, I made a huge mistake. I don't want to be here anymore. You know, this sucks. But, you know, once you sign the paperwork, you don't really have a choice. You're kind of stuck. I finished basic training. I was there for 4 months. I joined the infantry. You know, I had a choice of a lot of different jobs that I could do, but I chose to do that because I wanted to challenge myself. You know, and it was also in my mind what I thought the military was about. You know, I didn't want to go in and do computers. You know, I could have went to school for that. So I wanted to push myself. You know, I wanted to do all the schools. I wanted to just go as far as I could. And I was sent to Germany. That was my duty station. And I don't know if any of you guys have been there, but at 18 years old, Germany is a pretty awesome place because there's no drinking age. You know, I had housing. I was living in a barracks. I was getting a paycheck. We were working a pretty consistent schedule. You know, we would wake up and do exercises in the morning. You know, we would run a couple miles, do push-ups, sit-ups. We would come back. We would get our orders for the day, you know, whether that's cleaning our weapons, cleaning our vehicles, you know, executing maneuvers, whatever that may be. And then we were usually off, you know, 5 o'clock. We had weekends off. So I spent a lot of time traveling. And I traveled around to a lot of different cities. I saw a lot of different countries over there. And looking back on it, that was, you know, some of the finest moments of my life. You know, just being over there and hanging out with my buddies and traveling, and it's just all, taking in all these new experiences. It was just an awesome experience for a kid from a small town in New Jersey who had never really left the state before joining the military. And, you know, we do these trainings over there. We call them field rotations. And you would go out into the woods for 30 days, and you would basically just be completely cut off from civilization. You no electricity, no running water. You know, you're sleeping in a sleeping bag outside, and you wear all this equipment, these like lasers, and you know there's a whole another unit that wears lasers, and you just go at it, and you try to maneuver on each other, and you know. It's like a big game of laser tag, pretty much. You know, it sounds fun, but it's not very fun when it's like 25 degrees out and it's snowing on you, and you know you have to wake up and get dressed at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning to pull guard. You know, it gets pretty old pretty fast. And so we did two of these back to back. So we were out there for 60 days, and when we were out there, you know, all the rhetoric about the Iraq war had started. You know, the Saddam Hussein, you know, the weapons of mass destruction, this, that, and the other, you know, Iraq, Iraq, Iraq. And it just kept getting intensified. And, you know, by the time we had got back, it was everywhere. And that, you know, the war started shortly after we got back. And it was, you know, we remember watching it on TV and just seeing the, you know, seeing the bombs blowing up, seeing the tanks going by, seeing the infantry, and just remembering, you know, just thinking that we were going to be there. You know, this was no longer just some distant reality. This wasn't something that we were, you know, it wasn't a training mission. Things had definitely gotten real, because the unit that we were in, it was a mechanized infantry unit. We didn't have the capabilities of going to Afghanistan and operating in the mountainous terrain. But as soon as the war in Iraq started, you know, that all changed. So about a week after that, our unit got orders. And, you know, they give you a packet of orders. And in the orders, it tells you, you know, you're going to Iraq from this date to this date in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And you don't have a choice. You can't say no. You can't say, oh, you know, I'm sick, I don't want to go. You can't go home. You know, you just, once you're in, you're in. You know, you have to fulfill your commitment. And so, you know, this is tough news for a lot of us to digest. It's, you know, it's a hard thing to know, you know, that you're going into a war, that you're going into this dangerous environment. You know, the mentality amongst all of us just started to change. You know, we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know, you know, if we were going to live or die when we went there. And so most of us, we just tried to fit in as much as possible, as much traveling, as much partying. You know, we just tried to maximize the time that we had left. And literally the last couple months was just a blur. You know, we were out every night. We were just trying to have a good time. And we deployed in 2004. We were sent to Kuwait first. Kuwait is, you know, pretty much everything I thought that a desert would be. It was rolling dunes, camels. You know, we were out in a tent. It was 120 degrees. You know, we had 40 pounds of body armor on, you know, carrying packs, doing maneuvers. And it was, you know, it was tough. It was a tough environment. You know, it was uncomfortable. You know, we had probably 100, 120 people living in a room that's maybe two times the size of this. You know, all living in cots. You know, everyone's on different schedules. Just, you know, it was definitely an eye-opening experience. But, you know, the military does that to try to acclimate you, you know, physically. You know, they try to acclimate your maneuvering and prepare you for going into Iraq. And so we were there for 32 days. And we moved into Iraq after that. We moved into Tikrit, which is Saddam Hussein's hometown. It was probably one of the worst places you could go. It was full of, you know, Saddam Hussein loyalists, Ba'ath Party, you know, members of the Ba'ath Party, high-ranking officials in the military, you know, Fedayeen. It was Republican Guard. It was just everyone that was really loyal to him, you know, his extended family. And, you know, we had set up in his hometown. And, you know, when you get there, you do, it's a, called a right seat ride. And so, you know, there was already a unit there when we got there. And they had been there for about, I think, 8 or 10 months. And they were, you know, they take you under their wing. So you get in the Humvees with them. You know, you patrol around the city. They show you, you know, the neighborhoods that you should watch out for. They show you how to react in different situations. You know, things that you should do, things you shouldn't do. They basically teach you how to survive over there. And so you do this for about a week. And after a week, there was a change of command ceremony. And at this ceremony, our unit officially took over for that sector. And so when we got up to Tikrit, there was an entire brigade that was in charge of the city. The city had about 30,000 people in it. A brigade is about 4,000 or 5,000 people that were, you know, tasked to lock it down. And we relieved them with about 1,200. So immediately we were severely undermanned, overtasked, you know, from the second that we got there. And at this change of command ceremony, we had all our commanders met up, our company commanders, which is pretty much a father figure. You know, it's someone who is usually highly educated. Our company commander was a West Point graduate. He was a Ranger. He would, you know, give you the shirt off his back if you asked him. He was just such a nice guy. And they were, after this ceremony, they split up and they were moving back to the smaller patrol bases. And as they were moving across the city, their Humvee was hit with an improvised explosive device. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's, you know, in this particular one, it was an artillery shell. It was about this big. It was probably 90 to 100 pounds of explosives. And it was two of them wired together. And they had buried it in some garbage. You know, they put it in, covered it up with trash bags, put it on the side of the road. They had a wire that ran from there up to a building, which was probably 50 feet away. And then as the Humvee drove by, someone pushed a button, and it exploded. And this was early on in the war in 2004. And we had no armor on our vehicles. We had, you know, we didn't have a door or a roof on it. And the explosion, it ripped through the Humvee. It killed the company commander instantly. And it, one of my good friends who, you know, I used to travel with, you know, he stayed in my room all the time. I would go out with him. You know, I would travel with him, party with him. He was one of my close friends, and he was killed also. And this was the first 7 days that we were there. You know, the deployment continued like this. You know, it's hard to really describe what it's like over there. You know, I try to relate it to something that you might experience around here. It's just, you know, go downtown. Go to downtown Anchorage, you know, and have people out there who are shopping, driving around in their cars, you know, trying to go about their daily business. And somewhere out there, there's a group of people that are heavily armed, and they're trying to kill you. And they have the element of surprise. You know, they speak the language, you don't. You know, they know the town, they know the culture, and they're waiting for you. And so you're always just on edge, you know. Every time you're over there, it's, you know, you never even see the enemy half the time. They don't wear uniforms. You know, they might run up and stick an AK-47 around a corner, shoot a whole magazine, and just take off. And, you know, it's over in 1 second. Or they'll use the explosive devices. You know, they'll stick a gun over the wall and they'll shoot at you. You know, they'll shoot from a building, you know, inside a building from a window. You never really know where they are. You never know when it's going to hit you. And so you're always just left with this feeling of just tenseness. Like you're just driving around, just waiting for something to happen. You know, the majority of the time we had contact with the enemy, it was us responding to them attacking us. You know, it was never really us on the offensive. It was just trying to fight our way out of whatever ambush that we were in and trying to survive and get out of there. You know, most of the time we didn't catch the people who did it. You know, we never caught the guys who blew up, you know, my friend and our company commander. You know, those were things that we just had to take on the chin. You know, and it's really tough to digest. You know, I remember hearing that news and just, you know, just having so many different emotions going through my body, you know. Terror, you know, anger, just hopelessness, just anything you could possibly think of. You know, it was every range of emotions. And, you know, over there you don't have the luxury of grieving. You know, you're not able to properly process what happens, because 4 hours after that we were back out on missions and we were looking for the people who did it. You know, and it just continued like this. We went out every single day. You know, we would do patrols for 12 or 16 hours, come back in, and then we would have to do guard, you know, or we would have to do something on the base. And it was just, you know, every single day, you never get enough sleep. You know, when you get back to the base, you know, you have to worry about mortars. You know, the base that we lived on, it got mortared 181 days straight. And, you know, you don't hear them coming in. It's just, you know, a rocket flies out of the sky and hits some building, or a mortar drops out of the sky and hits something, and you don't know where it came from. You don't know when it's going to hit. So you're not even safe, you know, when you're supposed to be decompressing. You know, you're worried when you're in the shower if a rocket's going to fly through this side of the Connex and explode, or, you know, if a mortar's going to drop on you. You know, when you're outside just standing around joking. And, you know, we did a lot of missions. They're called observation posts. And what we would do is we would go into a building that was abandoned. Sometimes it was occupied. And we would set up, you know, on the roof, or we would set up inside a room. And we would monitor an area where there was a lot of enemy activity. So we would try to catch people that were, you know, doing things. We were planting IEDs, people with weapons. You know, we just tried to report what we saw, and if necessary, you know, we would engage them. And so we were doing these all the time. You know, we would move in small groups, usually 3 or 4 people, to try to keep our profile low. You know, we would go out at night, try to sneak around. We would, you know, climb across rooftops. Sometimes there'd be people sleeping on the roof, and you're, you know, sneaking across it as they're sleeping, you know, over them. You know, going through backyards, just trying to stay hidden. And we did one of these missions one day. We moved in about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we moved into an abandoned hotel. And, you know, we were in there all day for about 12 hours, and we got the call to break it down and to move back in. And so, you know, we're moving back in, and we're cutting across people's backyards. You know, we're trying to stay out of sight, and we get to an area where we can't cross any further. You know, the fence was too high. We couldn't scale a building, so we had to get out onto the street. And we get out onto the street, and, you know, immediately I knew something was wrong. There was people that started to run. You know, there was cars that started to peel out. And this is a really bad indicator when you're over there, because most of the time the people knew when the enemy was in the area, and they would try to get out of there before, you know, they would get caught in any type of crossfire. And so we saw this happening, and, you know, I just knew that something was up. I knew it was bad. And I remember I looked over and I saw these 2 little kids on the curb, and they were just, you know, young kids, probably 8 years old, and they just had this terrified look on their face. You know, and they were just totally frozen in fear. And I took a couple more steps, and I just heard just snap, 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 boom, 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 boom. And it felt like somebody ran up and tried to kick my leg out from underneath of me. And, you know, in that moment, I realized what was going on, and I realized that I was being shot at, and that I was caught in the middle of an ambush. And what the enemy had done was there was a wall probably about this high. We were on the sidewalk. You know, there was a street over here and some stores on the other side, and they had waited until we were out in the middle of the wall, so there was really nowhere to run. And they had opened up on us with 3 AK-47s from across the street. And the first volley hit me. I was hitting my leg, and I just stumbled. And I, you know, once I realized what was going on, my body just immediately started moving. You know, my fight or flight syndrome kicked in, and I just took off. And the whole time I was running, there was just bullets. Boom, 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 boom. I could see them hitting the wall next to me. You know, I could see them sparking. You know, I could taste the dust as it went into my mouth. It was just, it was the absolute most terrifying experience I've ever had. You know, I was pretty certain that I was going to die. You know, I just remember thinking as I was running, like, this is it. Like, this is the way it's going to end for me. I'm going to die on this sidewalk in Iraq. And I just was just so scared. You know, I had so much that I wanted to do still. You know, I just didn't want to die. And, you know, by some miracle, you can call it, I made it around the corner. And I remember standing there, and I was just in shock. And I was looking at my buddy, and he was looking at me, and we were both just, like, totally just in this state of shock about what had just happened. And, you know, I was like, man, I think I just got shot. And he was like, really? I said, yeah, man, look at my leg, dude. And at this point, it was just blood. You know, I'd seen blood coming out of it. It started to hurt. Yeah, I didn't feel anything when it initially happened. I didn't feel anything when I was running. You know, all I knew was that my leg wouldn't work correctly. And, you know, some nice Iraqi guy opened up his gate, and he let us into his yard, and he locked it behind us because we were still getting shot at. And, you know, another observation post came from their position and came to our aid to help us out. And, you know, they put a tourniquet on my leg, and they threw me in the back of a Humvee, and I was sent back to to our base where I was put on a helicopter, and they flew me over to a field hospital on the outskirts of the city. And field hospital is pretty much like an impromptu hospital they set up. It was like tents. It was just a little compound right next to the runway. I was laying down, on a stretcher in there, and all the doctors are, over at the computer a couple feet away, and they're looking at me, they're laughing, they're joking around. I see them giggling at me and pointing, and they come over and they're asking me my favorite numbers, like, what was your number in sports? What's your favorite? What's your lucky number? And I was just like, what? I don't understand how this is relevant at all. And they went on to say that, I was one of the luckiest people that they've seen, through that hospital. And I was just like, please elaborate, because I don't feel so lucky right now. And so they went on to tell me that the one bullet, it went through my leg around my calf region, and it went between the tibia and fibula, and it came out the front, and it didn't hit any bones. The space that it went through was only big enough for a bullet of that exact caliber to fit through. And I had another bullet that just grazed my hand. So, I was in a full sprint running through all that gunfire, and I managed to make it out pretty much okay. I mean, for the most part. And so, since it didn't hit my bone, the military decided that I wasn't serious enough to ship out of the country and that I was able to return to duty. And so they sent me back to my base. It took me about 3 months to recover. I spent the majority of my time recovering. I was working in the radio room, so I would work from 8 at night till 8 in the morning every single day, and I would just monitor the radios, and I could hear everything that was going on in sector. I could hear all the stuff that my buddies were going through, everything that was happening. I was just listening to it and trying to coordinate it. And it just really started to bother me. I was going through physical therapy over there. And, I was at an appointment one day. And my doctor was, he was like, you were shot over there in ambush. You've been in infantry. You've been here 8 months. He's like, I want you to go talk to someone in the mental health office. And I was like, for what? I feel fine. Like, I'm okay. I'm alive. I have my leg. It could have been much worse. And he said, just don't do it for me. And I said, okay. So I left that day, and I totally blew off the appointment. I went home and played video games. Back to our base, my little building where we were living. And I came back the next day, and he was asking me, how did it go? How did the appointment go? And I said, it went pretty good. He's like, oh yeah, what'd you talk about? And I said, what happened and stuff. And he's like, yeah, well, that's funny, because I called him, and he said, you never showed up. And he said, first off, don't lie to me ever again. And then he said, if you don't go, I'm not going to treat you anymore. And so I didn't have a choice at that point. And so I went there that day. And, I get into this office, and it's really nice in there. It's cool. It's got air conditioning. It's got nice couches and TVs. And this, jolly guy comes up, and he starts talking to me. And, this guy had never left the base. He had never gone on a patrol, probably. He spent the entire 8 months just hanging out in this air-conditioned room. And for me, I just could not bring myself to respect him. I just totally, it just shut me down immediately. I was like, what does this guy know about anything? How is he going to help me? How is he going to talk to me about what I am going through if he has no clue? So I said the bare minimum to get out of there, and I got, whatever paperwork I had to get signed, and I left. And I went back to my doctor, and I was just like, you know, it's not something I'm interested in. You know, I talked to him, and he said, okay, you know, what can he do? After about 3 months, I was able to run again. You know, I had a slow jog. I felt confident enough to go back out on missions. You know, my squad was 2 people down already, including me, but they still had the same amount of missions to do. You know, I never really wanted to let what happened to me kind of define me in life. I didn't want to, you know, have that nagging in my head of why didn't I go back out on missions? You know, why, you know, what could have happened or why didn't I go? I never really wanted to think like that. And so I just decided to just go for it, just throw myself out there. And the first mission that I went back out, we got shot at. And I was in the back of a Humvee, and I totally froze. You know, I was laying down in the back. I was trying to push my head into the corner. You know, I was just completely terrified. And in my mind, I was like, you know, it's happening again. You know, I'm going to get shot again. And so, you know, the last month was extremely just, it was full of just extreme paranoia, anxiety. You know, every single thing I saw, every piece of garbage, every single movement in every window, I thought it was another attack coming. You know, I was completely just amped up. But luckily, nothing else happened. I finished the last month of my deployment, and we got back to Germany. And it really, when we got back, it really felt like the whole experience had been some type of just long nightmare. It was so surreal because here we were all back in our old barracks in our own old rooms. You know, we had all just gone through this long deployment, just, you know, all kinds of things happening over there. And, you know, we never felt the need to really address that, to really talk about it. You know, all we wanted to do was just kind of get on with our lives, just move, you know, forward, you know, try to enjoy ourselves, try to have fun. We didn't want to focus on that stuff. We were all just glad to be alive.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Iraq War veteran Brian Adams. He was recorded speaking at UAA on February 21st.
You know, our unit was one of the first ones to do any type of focused reintegration. It was back in 2005, and it was interesting. It was a giant tent, like a circus tent, and there was a bunch of tables in there. And, you know, in these tables there was, you know, you had your financial stuff, your household goods stuff, your car stuff, and one of the stations was also mental health. And, you know, you go through with your check boxes and you get everything checked off on. And when we got to the mental health station, there was, you know, a woman there with a, you know, a folding table, you know, a folding chair, some fabric partitions. And, you know, 10 feet away was all your buddies that could hear everything you were saying. And so, you know, I just remember the questions they were asking also. It was these questionnaires like, okay, you know, did you hear loud noises when you were over there? You know, were you scared for your life when you were over there? And we were all just thinking, like, who is filling out these questionnaires? Like, do they even have a clue? And, you know, there had been a rumor circulating that if you had been found to have any type of, you know, disorder or you were flagged, that they could keep you on base for another 6 months. And, you know, I don't know anyone who would want to stay there another 6 months after just finishing, you know, a 12-month deployment. And so we just said the bare minimum, say whatever we had to say to, you know, get our checkbox checked off, and we just moved out. And, you know, from that point until I was officially diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder was about 2 years. I had gotten out of the military about 6 months after I got back from Iraq. you know, I moved back to New Jersey, back into my parents' house. Things were, you know, the first month that you're back, 2 months that you're back, you just kind of ride this high. You know, you're just so glad to be back. Everything's new. You know, it's so exciting. Everyone's, you know, taking you out. They're buying you drinks. You're just like, yeah, it's like the greatest thing ever. You know, you get out. You're just so glad to be home. And after a while, it starts to, you know, it starts to go away. You know, that it starts to fade away. And, you know, reality starts to sink in. You know, for me, when I got back to my house, my parents were in the middle of a pretty nasty divorce. They were actually suing each other. They were still kind of living in the same house, partially. So it was an extremely awkward situation to be in. You know, I didn't really have any type of plan. I didn't have a job lined up. I wasn't, you know, accepted into any school. I didn't have any plan to get into school. I was just so burnout from being over there. And I felt like I had lived an entire lifetime in that 1 year. You know, it was the longest year of my entire life. You know, I felt, you know, every single day it just drug on. You know, you're looking at the camera, you know, looking at your calendar, just, you know, one day at a time. You had to take it. You know, being over there, it's, you know, you get phones and you get internet and stuff, but you know, you're on Facebook and you're looking at all your buddies, and they're having the time of their lives at these parties and concerts and hanging out on the beach, and you know, you're stuck in this hellhole. You know, you have no escape from it. You know, you're talking to your parents over there and you can just hear the fear in their voices. You know, you can hear them just, you know, barely being able to keep together, you know, without crying. It was just so tough. I mean, emotionally, physically, it just really took a lot out of me. And, you know, when I got back, I was just so burnt. I just felt like I couldn't do anything. You know, I had a lot of free time on my hands. I would, you know, pace around my house because I could never, like, sit still. You know, I always had to have some type of, you know, stimulation. I had to have something going on. I had to distract myself, because whenever I would stop and just think about, you know, what I had gone through, about the things that happened in Iraq, it would be too much. You know, I would just make me angry. I would get super depressed, anxious, just everything. And so I constantly was just looking for ways to distract myself. You know, when I would lay in my bed at night, it would just be like a running picture show in my mind. You know, all the things I saw, you know, I would hear the sounds, I would, you know, smell the smells. It was just so vivid. You know, it was so fresh in my mind. You know, I would have nightmares where I would wake up covered in sweat, like I just ran 10 miles. You know, and the nightmare would be so vivid that I wasn't really sure if I was awake or not. You know, if this was really reality or if I was still back in Iraq. You know, it was hard for me to distinguish it. I would be so disoriented. You know, I couldn't sleep. I spent quite a bit of time just basically being nocturnal. You know, I would sleep until 5 or 6 at night. You know, when the sun started to go down, then I'd get up because I felt more comfortable at night. You know, there was less people out. You know, there was less traffic on the roads. There was just less things to deal with. You know, I felt more comfortable. I spent a lot of time in Iraq, you know, on missions at night. And, you know, the only thing that really helped me was, you know, when I would drink or when I would smoke weed. You know, it was the only thing that really made me feel better. It was the only thing that distracted me. You know, when I would get drunk, it would shut my brain down. You know, I would have that carefree feeling that I was really seeking. Because when I was over there, I felt like I had lost my innocence. You know, I felt like I had lost the ability for me to really let loose and just enjoy myself. You know, I was constantly just tense still. You know, even when I got back, it was just, you know, I look at it, it's like, you know, it was like a spring. You know, I was totally pushed in. My spring was just, I couldn't go any further. And it just took a long time for me to really get back to where I needed to be. And, you know, I spent a lot of nights just blasted, you know, blacked out. I would go out and, you know, I would cause all kinds of problems with my friends. You know, I would get in arguments with people. I always took, like, the most negative approach to any situation because that's the way I was thinking, was just negativity. You know, it just affected me so much that, you know, it got into every aspect of my life. You know, I feel like I didn't have any more dreams. You know, I didn't have any more goals. I felt like the rest of my life was just going to be just this miserable existence, you know, trying to just bumble through life, basically. You know, I had no plans. And, you know, there was a particular string of nights where I, you know, I was pretty wasted. And, you know, I destroyed some property that was pretty valuable to my mom. And, you know, I had no recollection of it at all. I didn't remember anything. I don't remember doing it. I don't remember how I got there. I don't remember any of it. All I remember is waking up and having my mom standing over me. And she basically told me that she didn't want me around anymore. She didn't want me in the house anymore. You know, she couldn't deal with it. And so I just said, screw it. And I ended up leaving. I was sleeping on the couches in my cousin's house, you know, in his garage. I would move around to my different cousins', you know, houses and just kind of stay with them until they would get tired of it also. And I hit a point where I didn't really have many options left. And I remember I was talking to, you know, my buddy who I served in Iraq with. This guy had slept under me, you know, my entire deployment. We had been on the same missions together. And he was kind of feeling the same way. He was living at his parents' house. Didn't really know what he was going to do. You know, couldn't really socialize with people. And, you know, we talked about moving in together. And he talked about trying to get into school. And he said, you know, what do you think about this? And I said, you know, let's do it. I didn't have anything to lose at that point in my life. And so I just dropped everything. And I moved to Massachusetts, and I moved in with him. And, you know, I immediately felt comfortable again because it was the same feeling as when we had just got back from Iraq. You know, I was there with someone I served with. He understood everything that I had gone through. I understood everything that he had gone through. And it was just that, you know, that mutual, that bond, that unspoken bond that was there. You know, there was no need to really elaborate. It took a lot of the pressure off. You know, our mentality changed into, you know, here we were in the civilian world now, and, you know, we still had to look out for each other, but now we're on a different mission. You know, and our mission now is to, you know, try to operate in this realm, you know, outside the military, you know, as a veteran, and try to make something of our lives. And, you know, things were going okay. I decided to try to attempt to go to school. I started going to a community college up there, and I absolutely hated it. It was just a terrible experience. You know, I was in class. I would sit in the very back. I wouldn't participate. I didn't want to talk to anyone. You know, I would just listen to things people were talking about, you know, drama, gossip, all these things that I didn't care about at all. And it would just make me disgusted. You know, I felt like I was some type of, like, monster. you know, I was in there. I felt like I couldn't talk to these people. You know, they would just judge me or they would be afraid of me. You know, it was so hard. You know, I couldn't focus on school. You know, I didn't care about the classes I was in, you know, entry-level classes. You know, I did terribly. Couldn't retain information. I just felt totally isolated. I felt like an alien. And, you know, after my first semester, I just decided that school wasn't going to work for me. And so I essentially just said, I'm done with school. And I was in the VA hospital in Boston one day, and I'm in the, you know, reception office. It's the, you know, clinic for returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, and I'm trying to get a checkup on my leg. And, you know, the woman was in there, and she said, you know, it's going to be 45 days till your next available appointment. And, you know, something just triggered me. You know, I was already having a bad day, and when she said that, I was just, I let her have it. You know, I went into this rant. You know, I brought everything into it. I brought politics, the war, you know, America, how the VA hates us, just everything I could think of. You know, what I was just angry and frustrated about. And, you know, I went on for a couple minutes, and people were in the office, and they started to leave because they were uncomfortable. And I remember when I was done, the woman said, okay, you know, I want to take some more, you know, I'll take another look at your paperwork. And, you know, she's like, can you come with me? And she took me around the corner, and she said, just sit in here for a little while. And she took me into a room, and I get in there, and there's a couple people in there. You know, a few of them they're obviously Vietnam veterans. They had the, you know, some of the patches and pins on, and there's a couple younger guys. And I'm in there, and I'm listening to them talk about, you know, some of the ways they were feeling, you know, about the anger, about not being able to sleep, you know, everything, you know, not being able to relate. And, you know, I felt exactly the same way. I was, everything they were talking about was the same things that I was experiencing. And so she came back in, and she, you know, took me back to the office, and she's like, you know, what did you think about that? You know, she, I guess I should have mentioned, before she put me in there, she looked at my paperwork, and she was like, you know, you were in the military, you were in ambush, Purple Heart, you know, in Iraq for this long. And she said, you know, I think you may be having some residual issues. And, you know, I kind of joked with her, like, yeah, that's why I'm here. You know, my leg hurts. And she said, you know, I don't mean physical. And she went on to tell me that she started to explain to me. Or no, that was getting mixed up here. It's been a long day, I'm sorry. But when I came out of there, what she had basically did was, that room that I was in was a group therapy session. And so she essentially tricked me into going to a group therapy session. And, you know, she gave me a bunch of information to read to take home. And all the information was about post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I took it home, and I'm reading through it, and I'm looking at all these checkboxes, and I just remember I satisfied pretty much every single one of them. You know, I probably could have wrote stuff in there that they weren't aware of. And I remember that night I called my mom up, and I was talking on the phone, like, you know, hey, Mom, I was in the hospital today. I think I might have post-traumatic stress disorder. And she was like, oh, thank God. Oh, thank the Lord. And she went on to tell me that pretty much everyone in my family, you know, knew that I was going through stuff. My friends all knew it. You know, they were having meetings, you know, about how they were going to try to intervene on me and try to get me to see this. And it was just something that was completely oblivious to me. You know, the way I always looked at it was, you know, things would always get better if, you know, I moved and I thought moving would change everything. I said, my life will turn around, you know, or when I get into school, my life's going to turn around. Or if I get a girlfriend, my life will turn around. And it just never happened for me. You know, it never did. I just still had the same feelings everywhere I went. And so I went back in there the next day and I said, you know, I think I have post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, what do I do about this? What, you know, what is it? What are the next steps? What can I do? And she went on to, you know, explain to me everything, the treatment programs. And I just, you know, at that point in my life, I didn't have, again, I really didn't have anything to lose. And so I just decided to commit to it 100%. And I, you know, I focused on my treatment. I went through, you know, everything that was available. You know, I did groups, I did individual, you know, I got on medications to help me, you know, level myself out, to help me sleep. And I just, for about 6 months straight, I just focused my entire life on this. You know, everything that I did, I funneled it through the lens of mental health, you know, how it would affect me, how it would, you know, alter my situation in life. You know, am I dealing with this correctly? You know, am I coping positively, negatively? Just everything I experienced, I tried to remember, you know, what I was taught and how it would affect me. And after about 6 months, I felt that I was able to take on some more responsibilities. And so, you know, I decided that I wanted to try to go to school again. You know, I decided that I wanted to try to go home and repair some of the, you know, relationships and just things that I damaged when I was home. You know, just friends and family, and just try to, you know, regain my life that I had prior to being in the military. And I moved back home. I started going to Rutgers. And I just remember at Rutgers, I had all those same feelings again. You know, I got into the school, I felt isolated. You know, I felt like I couldn't relate to anyone. And I started to get discouraged again. You know, I started to go down that path again. You know, it was tough. And I remember one day I was walking to the campus center, and, you know, I linked up with a guy, and he was a very large person, muscular guy, and he was sitting at a table, and he was, you know, had these super short shorts on and, you know, a tank top, and he was selling little stickers and magnets. And I was like, what is this guy doing? And you know, he comes up to me, he's like, oh, you want to buy a magnet, bro? You know, and he's like, got this look on his face, like he wants to like rip my head off. I was like, okay, sure. You know, what is it for? And, you know, I'm starting to talk to him, and I find out that he was a former Navy SEAL. You know, he had been a SEAL for 8 years, and he had just started going to college. And he was upset because he had, you know, he had a wife and a kid. He was on the GI Bill, and his payments were coming through. He was sick of the way things were. And he wanted to do something about it. So he was organizing a benefit run. You know, he was going to try to raise awareness through this run. And I was like, oh, you know, okay, how far are you running? You know, a couple miles. He was like, no, I'm going to run 65 miles. Yeah. And he wanted to run from our campus in Camden to our campus in New Brunswick to try to raise awareness. And, you know, I said, I'm not going to run with you, but I'll help you, you know, I'll help you raise awareness. And so, yeah, we started hanging out, and, you know, I come to find out that he had been in Iraq the same time I was. You know, it was just cool to, you know, to hear a different perspective, you know, to be with someone who's kind of in the same situation I was. You know, we would just hang out at the table. And we met more vets. You know, we kept meeting more and more people, you know, veterans in college. And just seeing all these guys in the same situation we were. You know, we started to hang out together. he eventually did his run. He made it. It took him 11 and a half hours straight. So, yeah, he's a pretty intense individual. But we started to hang out all the time, and we decided to form a student organization. So we formed the first student veterans group, you know, in the whole state of New Jersey at the time for our generation of veterans. And we started to really think about, you know, what we could do. How can we make changes? You know, we started out small. We started to, have meetings with faculty. You know, we would have meetings with staff people. We would have, you know, little panel discussions. We would bring in people from the area to talk about veterans issues, and we just tried to push it out there and just make people aware. But we were still, it wasn't getting through, you know, it wasn't enough. And so we resorted to a little bit more radical tactics, and we decided that the way we were going to do it was to basically ambush our university president at his annual address to the university. And so we went up there, and there was about 600 people in the audience, you know, deans, faculty, board of trustees, board of governors, everyone who's anyone at the university. And we had an entire list of where they were, you know, failing us, basically. And we just went through it. You know, we had suits on, stated our case, and it was a complete shock to the majority of people in there. You know, it was something that they had never heard of. And it was just like a mob afterwards of how can we help you? How can we do this? How can we assist you? And about 5 days after that, there was a committee formed on Iraq and Afghanistan veterans issues. You know, we had started, you know, we were the initial members of the committee, along with a couple other key administrators and faculty and, you know, just people within the university. And from that point, which is about 4 years ago until now, Rutgers is currently the number one school for veteran services. You know, we have an entire house. We have five, you know, full-time positions at the school. So things really turned around. But, you know, in that process, I was kind of busted out of my shell. You know, I was taken out of my comfort zone as far as, you know, speaking in public. You know, I would do panels. I would, you know, just talk in meetings. I started to use, you know, what was going on, use my personal story to try to benefit other people, you know, and benefit us, you know, as veterans within the university. And so I did a lot of panels with local other student veterans organizations in the state. I started to travel a little bit more, you know, to other states. And I was doing a panel discussion one day down at George Washington, and there was someone there from Active Minds in the audience. And they, you know, they liked my presentation. They liked what I was trying to do. And they invited me to try out for their speakers bureau. And so, you know, I said, hey, why not? You know, this is something that I think is important, you know, something that I feel, you know, this is a conversation that needs to be had. And so I tried out. I was accepted. From that point, which is about 2.5 years ago, till today, I've done probably 30 or 40 different presentations. You know, I still get nervous. You know, it's still something that I'm not entirely comfortable with. You know, public speaking never came naturally to me. I'd always been just a shy person. But for me, I really feel that, you know, it's a duty at this point. You know, I feel that mental health in general in this country is just something that is not being handled properly. You know, this is an issue that, you know, as many as 1 in 4 adults have some type of diagnosable mental health disorder. You know, that's 1 in 4 people in this room. But, you know, who's talking about it? You know, who's focusing on it? It's something that there's so much negative stigma out there. You know, you have things like, what happened in Connecticut, you know, in the elementary school. You have, you know, in the media, it's violence, mental health, violence, mental health. It's just further stigmatizing people. You know, for me, I really feel that if I had seen a presentation like this from a human perspective, you know, on a personal level, when I had first gotten back or when I was getting out of the military, I feel that it really would have helped me, you know, overcome some of the, if not overcome, it would have helped me be more aware of what was going on, you know, in my life. And thankfully, there's a lot more focus within the military. You know, they have mandatory one-on-one mental health screening now. You know, there's a lot of just educational, you know, programs that they're trying to get out there through the transition programs in the military. And so there's a lot more awareness, but yeah, you know, I just feel in society it's still, there's still just such a negative stigma. I mean, I feel a lot of people would rather, you know, put on a face, you know, put on this mask and, you know, lie to themselves and be miserable, you know, instead of facing the fear of being judged, or, you know, being honest and accepting the fact that, you know, maybe there is something going on. Maybe there's some things that I can't really handle on my own. You know, that was one of the most important factors for me, was, you know, just understanding that this was something that, you know, thousands of people across the country were experiencing. You know, PTSD can be caused by sexual assaults, car accidents. You know, there's a whole variety of ways that you can get it. You know, it's a normal reaction to an abnormal circumstance. You know, and the fact that I wasn't aware, and the fact that, you know, I didn't have any type of like intervention, it really held me back. You know, I feel that it held me back. And so I don't want to see other people that may be struggling, I don't want to see that in them. You know, I don't want, you know, it not only holds you back as an individual, it holds back our society. You know, if we constantly have people who are afraid to talk about it, constantly judging each other, you know, putting on these facades, you know, who is that really helping? You know, it's not helping you, because you're not going to be able to reach your full potential as a person. You know, instead of getting help, you know, getting on a path, you know, where you're going to strengthen yourself, you know, become more positive, you know, learn new tools, learn new ways to deal with it. You know, so for me, I just feel like it's a duty now. You know, I have to use my personal story to help others. You know, I've been doing it for a while. I've traveled all over the place. This is definitely one of the coolest places I've been, though. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on your campus. There's a lot of good programs for veterans, which is really awesome to see. I got to meet with a few of them today. There's also, you know, an Active Minds chapter. You know, the faculty advisor is sitting right there. And, you know, they're in the process of trying to get their organization rolling, trying to get some events going. And, you know, I encourage all of you to join. You know, it's something that we need to do, you know, as a species. And it's something, I mean, I don't mean necessarily mean join that organization, but, you know, it's something that you have to overcome within yourself. You know, you have to take an honest look at yourself in the mirror and just really, you know, ask the tough questions. So, I mean, now I'm going to open it up to the question and answer session, but that pretty much concludes, you know, what I have to say tonight. So thank you guys.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Iraq War veteran Brian Adams. Hosted by the UAA Integrated Suicide Prevention Initiative as part of the Active Minds Speakers Bureau, Brian's talk was recorded at the University of Alaska Anchorage on February 21st, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.